All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Hey, and welcome once again to a program, Veterans Radio, originating right here from our flagship station in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. Veterans Radio, my partner Dale is on vacation today. He'll be back next week. Boy, we got a lineup for you folks. It's the 71st anniversary, not today, but, you know, a few days ago of the atomic bomb. And for those of you that are too young, man, it really changed the world, to say the least, right? Right. So, well, but before we go, the band, right, how's the band doing? They're doing fine. They're taking a break now. Good. All right. So we're going to be getting back with the atomic bomb, Japan, the United States, in just a moment. But before that, let's catch up on a little bit of local news. The Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial has Kissing the War Goodbye, a massive reenactment of the kiss that marked the end of World War II. Now, what they did, and it's today, it's actually going on, right? I know. Well, why are you talking about this, Bob? Because they have this huge statue. It's about 30 feet high of the kiss. The kiss, the famous kiss on Times Square of the sailor kissing the nurse. And it will be in Plymouth, Michigan, on permanent display. So it's called The Kiss. I think we all remember that. Let's see, reading. It's going to be, yes, at Plymouth. So how do you find out about it? Well, I guess you call the Plymouth Chamber of Commerce, because that's where they're going to be placing it. So that'd be kind of cool, something to do during the summertime. Get yourself out there. And here's something else you can do. Not quite the end of summer, though. The annual pig roast of the Washtenaw County VBA Chapter 310. Sunday, September 11th at the VFW Post, 423 Wagner Road, Ann Arbor. It's going to be a wonderful, wonderful dinner. Lots of merchandise, and there's going to be military vehicles, music, and parties for Hail Local. Well, it's going to be great. Thanksgiving dinner for Dawn Farm residents. Wow, okay. This is a whole day that's going to be at the Washtenaw County VVA Chapter 310 Annual Pig Roast. That's Sunday, September 11th at VFW Post 423. And folks, pay attention. Take a look out at the events. A lot of the veteran organizations are using the end of summer and Labor Day as a time to raise money. So if you get a chance, go to some of these events. I think you'll have even, well, I'm not a veteran. Well, you can go anyway. Meet some veterans. They're not going to bite, right? How many veterans out there bite? See, nobody raises their hand. It's a great group. Okay. Well, getting to our first guest right now. And, yes, he's on. Our screener is shaking her head. Yes, everybody's happy. And Tom Jones, yes, the Tom Jones. Those of you that are old enough to remember the movie Tom Jones that won an Academy Award with Albert Finney. And oh, I'm trying to think of the gal. Great movie. If you get, I don't know how you get movies today. What do? Hulu or something? Netflix? Anybody know how that? How do you do? How about it, Derek? How do you get movies? Netflix?
Yeah, Netflix, Hulu. Yeah, those are two of them.
Folks, take a look at and download or whatever it is you do to Tom Jones. Fun movie. But we have Tom Jones. No, not the Tom Jones. But we do have a Tom Jones with us. He is a Livonia resident, Livonia, Michigan. He's a veteran of the 101st Airborne Division. And two deployments to Iraq. Thank you for your service. He's a project coordinator of Michigan Operation Freedom Outdoors. Michigan Operation Freedom Outdoors. Let's give a big Veterans Radio welcome to Tom Jones. Tom.
Hey, Bob. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing, oh, yeah, brother. Folks, I'm 101st Airborne, too. So whenever we meet each other, we all have a little greeting. And
Yeah,
all the way, right?
All the way, yeah.
We get a chance to wear the, you know, that's the number one patch that sold is the Eagle Patch, the 101st.
Oh, yeah. Oh, without a doubt. And it's the fifth most recognized symbol in the world, Bob, next to currency and okay. You know, people know that Screaming Eagle from every corner of the globe.
I believe that. You know, what's really cool, too, when you're walking, let's say it's somewhere like the VA, and you're walking down the hallway and you kind of pass a group of guys, and you already pass them. You're looking the other way, and somebody will go, airborne. Just like that. Yeah. You know, it's a camaraderie. You all have to be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got to be there to understand. Tom, you are the project coordinator for the Michigan Operation Freedom Outdoors. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, basically, Bob, it's a big collaborative of affiliates. It started off about in September 2013. It was an idea of the Michigan DNR and the Eisenhower Center and, you know, various affiliates. But we got up and running about September 2014 was our first event. So what we've done is we break down barriers to get people back into outdoor recreation, you know, whether it's, you know, a disabled veteran, you know, coming back, or, you know, it's maybe came home 30 years ago and they have some troubles getting back into the outdoors. We help to break those barriers. And, you know, people with disabilities, you know, civilians around that, you know, I like to tell everyone it's for everyone that I fought with and everyone that I fought for. So if anybody has a barrier getting into the outdoors, we, you know, we get together and we do what we do best. You know, we just take care of people and go out and get in the outdoors.
Now, are you located elsewhere besides Michigan?
No, with Michigan Operation Free, we have various
chapters.
State lands. No, there's no chapters, but there's various, you know, people come out of the woodwork when they hear, you know, what we're doing, and, you know, word of mouth through the veteran community travels fast, and, you know, we have various landowners, you know, people coming up in Ohio, and, you know, we have ranches out in Arizona that have offered to, you know, let us send people out there and put people on different species and, you know, different game out there for hunting.
So you get veterans to volunteer to work with disabled folks, including disabled veterans. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, it started off, like I said, word of mouth. So we get a lot of veterans that have been coming out. And you give veterans a mission, you know, just this is an extended enlistment day for a lot of guys. Now you get a lot of people, you know, for instance, 100% disabled veterans, they can go out and get all their deer tags, fishing licenses, and everything. You know, it's the least we can do for them. It's free if you're 100% disabled. But a lot of these guys are coming out, and, you know, they're beating me to the gate before that first cup of coffee. And, you know, they get that sense of camaraderie back. And we just, you know, we have a hell of a time whenever we get together. So,
and what you look for and need and always can, I don't mean need, but you always can use volunteers. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, for instance, we have a lot of hunts that are coming up. The Natural Resources Commission has allocated 600 acres for us, for, you know, solely for people, 100% disabled veterans and people with a standing, permit to hunt from a standing vehicle. And those all qualify you for early hunts. So we're going to be cycling 24 individuals for the entire, regular firearm season every 3 days. So that's, you know, very impactful hunts on, you know, land that's usually pretty busy at time of year, but it's going to be secluded. And we have an upcoming property that hasn't been hunted in over a decade that I'll be putting out here soon on myinfo.org.
So they're coming out volunteering to how many veterans or how many participants do do you usually get out with one of your soirees?
Well, last year between there's an early firearm hunt in September, another one in October, and then we had the regular archery season and firearm season and late antler list. But between just last year's season, I personally took people out on over 100 outings. So that's all around the Sharonville State Game Area where we've kind of launched this, where we have, you know, accessible deer blinds on public land sitting on food plots with, you know, I have action-tracked wheelchairs, so I'm taking out double amputees and you know, people with cerebral palsy and MS, and, you know, these are people that, you know, lost their legs in Vietnam or just are paralyzed, you know, and we're getting them that, the freedom to go back to, you know, hunting, not getting drug out on a sled to a deer blind. They're going out on their own, you know, and it's pretty pretty impactful. That's my harvest. When I can get somebody out into a blind, and, you know, maybe they got that feeling, you know, when they were running the woods when they were 10 years old, you know, out in the woods.
Yeah. And nature heals. It's a healer. How can they get in touch? We're just about out of time. How can they get in touch with your organization?
Well, there's different ways. Right now we have a lottery on Michigan.gov. So I do have a website at Michigan. I'm sorry, www.myofo.org. That's myofo. And then, you know, like everyone else, we got a social media page. So that's where you get the latest and greatest. You know, it has links to various things on the state site on Michigan.gov for our lotteries. And but basically, you know, if you Google it, my phone number's on there, the one I'm talking on right now. So I tell everyone, if you got my number, you know, I have the amenities. So we'll work it out. You know, I have various affiliates.
Give us that website again, Tom.
Yep, that's www.myofo.org. It's M-I-O-F-O. And then the Facebook page is just Michigan Operation Freedom Outdoors. And, you know, but on the myofo.org, it has links to all of our social media, so you can follow us. And
well, thank you very much for taking your time. I know you got family over there. We wanted to have you in the studio. You couldn't make it. You certainly came through in the past, and will be in the future with all the veterans and other disabled people. So, Tom, thank you very much for being on our program, and we'll talk to you again before the hunting season.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too.
Wow. Okay. So we're going to get Kevin right there. Okay, there's Nina shaking her head. So let's see here. Let's go to a break, right? How about a PSA? You'll be right back right after this very important message. And we're back on Veterans Radio here on WHAM Radio 1600 Talk Radio, the flagship station for Veterans Radio. And now we're going to have on our program our next segment, and it will have two of our historians who've been very frequent guests on Veterans Radio, Kevin Hemel and John McManus. I'm getting everybody's. There we go. Okay. Kevin Hemel. All right. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, good to be here, Bob.
All right. And we don't have you on Skype this time, right?
No, sorry.
I know. Well, but thank you for being on. Kevin is a historian for the U.S. Air Force Chaplain Corps. He gives tours for the Stephen Ambrose Historical Organization, and he writes for World War II History Magazine. Also on the line with us is John McManus. John?
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Whoop, did we lose him? No, he's there, right? John?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, okay. Let's get a little volume on that. Yeah, Derek, get these guys up. Okay, why don't you give a little something on what it is that you're doing right now, John?
What I'm doing right now?
Right.
I've been doing a tremendous amount of research for a two-volume history of the Army in the Pacific Asia Theater. The first volume will probably be out in 2018, and it'll range from Pearl Harbor through the invasion of Bougainville. But it's more than just a campaign history. It's a look at the experience of soldiers and the logistical side of it, the cultural side. It's really, I just think, an absolutely fascinating story with a lot of lessons we can learn all these decades later.
Well, in a little bit, we'll get to the books that both of you gentlemen would like to promote. There we go. That's a good word. But let's get to our topic of the day, the atomic bomb. Here it was, August 1945, early in the morning, 4 o'clock, the Enola Gay. They were loading a device, hadn't been tested before, putting it on the plane. Kevin, were they sure the thing was going to take off?
They were confident about it taking off. I think there was more of a question about the bomb behaving the way it should once they got to target. In fact, when they took off, Tibbetts used every inch of the runway at Tinian Island for that takeoff. I should mention that General Leslie Groves, the Army commander in charge of the Manhattan Project, which built the bomb, ordered Klieg lights basically lining the runway because he knew this would be historic. And Colonel Paul Tibbetts leaned out of the window of the bomber and said, you know, turn those lights off and everybody get out of the way. And that's when they snapped that famous photograph of him popping out the window. The bomb was supposed to be armed on the ground, but there had been at least four B-29s that had had accidents off the end of the runway. So the officer in charge of arming the bomb told Tibbetts, you know, we've got to hold this off until we get airborne. And so once the B-29, you know, Oleguy got airborne and reached just about Iwo Jima, he climbs into the bomb bay and takes out the green safety plugs and replaces them with the red arming plugs, does this in the air, you know, in the bomb bay. And about 8 a.m. when they get over Hiroshima, they have what's called an aiming point, and that's a position on the ground that a navigator or a bombardier uses to get a fix on so that you can drop the bomb. Well, there was a T-shaped bridge that they had designated, and so it was one of the perfect aiming points they'd ever seen. And so once they saw that bridge and the bombardier lined up the bridge with the bomb site, he dropped the bomb. I think it was about 47 seconds till detonation. The crew had donned welding goggles in preparation for the flash. And as the bomb dropped, someone said that they actually thought it had failed after about 30 seconds. And then, boom, the entire cabin was lit up with green light. The tail gunner got the best view and snapped the iconic photograph of the explosion. And that detonation killed about 70,000 people on the ground, but it really, this was going to be now the end of the war. The United States had just, you know, created a weapon that was really a war ender. And Tibbetts immediately, the plane lurched up because the bomb weighed so much.
How much did it weigh? He hit him. Anybody know?
I want to say it was almost 1,000 pounds. John, is that too big?
I think that's in the neighborhood, yes.
So that's a half ton.
Yeah. And so once that left the bomb bay, I mean, the plane really lurched up, and Tibbetts put it into a right bank and, you know, brought the Oleguy home. It actually did fly on the second mission for Nagasaki as an observation plane, so it had more than just that one use. But Tibbetts had actually picked out the Oleguy, the bomber, from the assembly line. That's how serious he took this mission. The B-29, when it was being designed, it was basically the same time the bomb was being designed, and it was relatively accepted this would be the only delivery system capable of bringing a bomb of that magnitude to Japan. So that was something that was in the minds of the designers, you know, at least on the highest levels, was that this bomber, once it was completed and ready for use, that it was going to drop a bomb over Japan somewhere.
How many planes were there?
There were three B-29s and a number of fighter planes flying escort, and the other B-29s were really to film and take measurements of the reaction of the atomic detonation.
So that wasn't in case they got intercepted by fighters. There was no chance of that happening. Is that right?
No, there really wasn't. You know, once they arrived over Iwo Jima, that's when some fighter planes did join them. But, you know, it was a clear day, and there was no enemy ground fire. There were no planes coming up to meet them. It was, you know, straight out, drop the bomb and straight back. No peripheral activity at all. No attempts by the Japanese to stop it.
Did Tibbetts or any of the other crew by any chance see the, how should I say it, the experiment in July, the one when they dropped the bomb for the first time in the desert? Any of the crew, did these guys have any idea what was going to happen?
The Trinity experiment. No, I don't believe Tibbetts was there for it. That was really Leslie Grove and a lot of scientists. Tibbetts was fully briefed on it, as was the mission commander. But you know, there's a famous scene where one of the guys in the plane, as Tibbetts kind of crawled through the tunnel above the bomb bay, he'd gone in the back to take a nap and was crawling forward, and one of the guys said, "Sir, does this have something to do with atomic energy?" And he goes, "Yeah, you're kind of right on the money." And it wasn't until they actually got close that he made the announcement and told them, "Listen, you know, this is the payload we have. So the crew knew they were on a special mission, but they really, with the exception of the one guy that had read an article about atomic warfare or atomic power, they really did not know what they had in the belly of that bomber.
Did anybody, is there any photos that exist today of that bomb and the bomb bay and the airplane? The only one I see is the one where they're loading it into the bomb bay. Is there any film, anything that shows inside the airplane or any of that business?
Not to my knowledge, and I've done some research on it at the National Archives. The one man with the camera was the tail gunner, and he was basically isolated alone in the back of that plane. Like I said, he took the iconic photograph of the explosion as they went away from it. But no, unfortunately, there's nothing from inside the cockpit. The last photo, really, is Tibbetts waving goodbye to everybody.
John, what do you suppose would have happened? Well, no, I think we'll get into that because we're going to come back to this. We're just about ready for a break, right, folks? Oh, we got a few more minutes. Let's get back to John. John, what can you add to all this?
Yeah, I want to add a little bit about the planes and the overall strategic bombing campaign itself. The B-29 was really one of the most cutting-edge aircraft in the world at that point. And one of the things that separated it from other American heavy bombers that the Americans really did at that point lead the world in terms of strategic bombing technology was that the B-29 was a pressurized aircraft, which meant that above 10,000 feet, the crew didn't have to be on oxygen, and it was a more comfortable ride and all the rest. And so you'd already had a major strategic bombing campaign against Japan going on since roughly November 1944, and mainly from base in the Marianas, Tinian being the most primary example. So it had gone in the direction of firebombing by March 1945. And I think sometimes we tend to isolate on the atomic bombing because obviously it's the beginning of a new epoch in human history. But if we see the bombing in the larger context of the strategic bombing campaign, which is basically designed to just flame Japan out, to bring Japan to its knees, the American strategic bombing leaders had entered the war thinking in terms of, well, let's precision bomb the enemy's industry and not his civilians. That's out the window by March 1945. And so the loss of life, the immediate loss of life, in the firebombing raids against Tokyo, for instance, in March and May 1945, were actually higher than the atomic bombing in August 1945. So the atomic bombs are sort of a continuation of the sort of total war strategy of just laying waste to Japan.
Well, I've often wondered what would have happened had they had the Americans said, look, take a look over here on this such and such day and such time and watch what happens. Why wasn't that ever considered?
They did consider a demonstration bombing, but they discarded the idea for a couple of reasons. Of course, the most prominent reason was that it could fail, and then you've got a much worse situation on your hands. The other reason is you don't have that many bombs on hand, and you can't really afford to use one for that purpose, especially after the New Mexico test. And, you know, sort of as a corollary to that, even if you have a successful test, no one can really guarantee that the Japanese are going to say, oh, well, golly, you've got this now. I guess you've got us checkmated and come and occupy our country somehow. To me, that's always been a bit of a Candyland scenario, and I think that American policymakers viewed it as sort of untenable.
Well,
and if I could just add real quick, you know, all that kind of thinking we're talking about, we're doing relatively in peacetime. Remember, we were a country that had been at war for 4 years straight, and the war in the Pacific was unrelenting, almost no mercy at all on either side. So the idea of this, the demonstration, it just really didn't hold a strong place after 4 years of war.
Well, did MacArthur, I mean, he would have, if he knew, he would have been doing backflips. I mean, here we just had the Germans by their Wiener Schnitzel and they're done, and we got the Japanese by the chopsticks and we got this huge weapon. And MacArthur, did he know about, I mean, he knew about it, but what, did he have something to do with the, John, with the decision?
No, he had absolutely nothing to do with the decision. And actually, the time when MacArthur found out about the atomic bomb was the same as the rest of the world. He had absolutely no idea of the Manhattan Project until it happened.
Wow.
He had ultra clearance, which was, you know, the famous code breaking, you know, of both Japan and Germany. So he was using that intelligence. But of course, the Manhattan Project was something completely different and really ultimately the most closely guarded secret of the war until the bombs themselves were dropped. So, no, MacArthur doesn't have any hand in the decision or any aspect of this except the effect, which, of course, it helps lead to the surrender of Japan, and MacArthur really has the lead role in overseeing the occupation that follows.
I take it, we've only got about 30 seconds for the break, I take it that Eisenhower didn't know. Is that true, if, yes or no?
Absolutely. Eisenhower didn't know either. Even Truman didn't know until he was briefed about a week or so after becoming president.
Well, folks, we'll be right back. This is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. We'll be with Kevin Hemel and John McManus in the A-bomb, how it all got there in the aftermath. Don't go away. And we're back on Veterans Radio here at Talk Radio 1600 WAM. W-A-A-M. Somebody asked me, what does WAM stand for? Well, W-A-A-M. A-A, Ann Arbor. Media. Got it? W-A-A-M. Now you know. That'll get you a beer somewhere. Okay. I got John McManus, Kevin Hemel, our regular historians on the air with us. We're going over the details and the events leading up and the dropping of the atomic bomb, the welcoming of the atomic age. John, you got here on your notes to start with Saipan. Why don't you go ahead and start with that? How do we start with Saipan?
Yeah, Saipan is invaded June 15, 1944. The significance of Saipan, it's right in the heart of the Marianas Island chain, which was going to be well within aerial range to bomb Japan. So the Marianas constitute, and certainly Saipan itself, the inner ring of Japan's defenses. It also had been a German colony that was annexed by Japan after World War One. There were a lot of Japanese colonists there. There were, of course, the locals as well, Chamorros, Polynesians. It was a mixture of folks. It was a heavily populated island in its own way, and it was resource-rich. So when it's invaded by Marines and soldiers in mid-June 1944, you have on your hands one of the most bitter fights of the Pacific War. The Japanese, this is really the last major battle that they were determined to defend at the waterline against the American invasion. And they inflicted significant casualties on the Marines the first day. Eventually, you have an entire Army division come ashore, and the three divisions, U.S. Marines and U.S. Army soldiers, fight their way bit by bit across the island. And one of the most searing images of the Saipan campaign was a series of suicides by Japanese civilians who, once they were aware that the Americans were going to take over the island, decided to kill themselves and in many cases flung themselves off cliffs into the sea. Some held grenades to their heads. A whole series of terrible things that happened. Saipan was a little bit of a window into how much more ferocious the Pacific War was going to get, and it had been previously really bad.
Well, you know, folks, when we start thinking about invading Japan, by the way, that was called Operation Downfall, and we were making this plan, the Americans, and I keep hearing this, well, we were going to, why didn't we just blockade the bloody island? Everything has to come from the outside, the oil, except maybe their rice and their fish, but everything else, the oil, the rubber, natural resources, da-da-da-da, all had to come from outside. Why didn't we just blockade these folks, Kevin?
Well, actually, we were blockading them. We originally with submarine warfare, basically torpedoing anything along their trade lines. And then what was actually even more effective was B-29s dropping mines into the harbors, preventing them from being resupplied. So there was that successful effort going on, and you know, B-29s dropping mines could cover a much bigger swath than submarines. It was a much more efficient procedure. But then you're going to have the war just keep dragging out and dragging out. The American economy is all based on, you know, on this war. And, you know, the Americans have been fighting it for 4 years, and we really wanted it done. I know that the final war bond drive, there was a great deal of concern that Americans were becoming war-weary by 1945. They wanted it over and done with. And it just was not, you know, after fighting for so long, these really peaceful possible solutions, they really weren't even in the mix very heavily. There was always, you know, some dissenter, you know, coming up with these kind of ideas, but, you know, it had been just a long, drawn-out, brutal war, and it needed to end.
Well, and can I add something
else to that? Please, jump in.
Sure. There's financial reasons, too, in that the United States is absorbing considerable debt as a result of the war. And, you know, as Kevin pointed out very correctly, you know, a blockade is going to take time. And so this could go on for years. Navy estimates had it as at about somewhere in the nature of 2 years or so. So you're talking about deeper and deeper into debt, the draft continuing, social upheaval. But there's really more to it than that. We really can't implement a blockade fully until probably after the Battle of Okinawa in the summer of 1945. So, you know, yeah, you've got submarines operating, you've got the mines and all that, but a true blockade is still going to take time to implement over and above that. The other thing, too, the Soviet Union is going to be coming into the war in August 1945 at America's request. So if the Soviets come into the war, there's a very good chance that they're going to overrun portions of northern Japan, major portions of Manchuria, Mongolia, China, or in the alternate, if they don't succeed, that the Japanese Kwantung Army, which had been in occupation of Manchuria for years and was almost not quite self-sufficient, but could approach that because there's so many resources there, could operate as a sort of disjointed adjunct Japanese empire where the home islands themselves are under blockade. So there was a lot of inter-service tension over this idea of a blockade because it was something that the Navy tended to push because obviously they would have the lead role. The Air Force and the Army ground forces were nowhere near as enthusiastic as you might imagine.
Well, the Americans, the United States invited the Russians to enter the war at Manchuria, China, and at the same time, what else was going on in the United States high command when they were letting the Russians, because the Russians were coming through and gobbling up territory so fast, or going through China? What was going on here, and were the Chinese worried?
Everybody was worried. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thinking behind getting the Soviet Union in the war is that they would do a lot of the fighting and dying on continental Asia instead of Americans, and that they would, at a minimum, tie down maybe half the Japanese ground forces while we invaded the home islands. At the same time, the U.S. had been frustratingly dealing for over 3 to 4 years now with Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists in China, nominally the main government of China, although the communists were great contestants too, and there's a civil war going on in China. So by 1945, the U.S. is about fed up with dealing with Chiang Kai-shek, with supplying him, and he won't fight the way we want to, he won't rule the way we want to, all of these kinds of things, these sort of problems that we're going to become very familiar with in the post-war years, particularly in Asia, other places like Vietnam. You see all this happening in China at the same time. So, yeah, to answer your question, Bob, everybody is a mess. Everybody is worried by 1945 in China. And you have on your hands a really perilous situation. So the longer the war continues, the longer Japan remains as a power in this whole mix, the worse off it is really for everybody concerned.
I've got to jump to this because I'm what you said earlier about President Truman. He didn't know until after the explosion in July. Of course he knew after that, but
No, I didn't say that. I said that he was not even briefed on the existence of the bomb until a few days after he became president. So he had
no idea
of the Manhattan Project.
Okay.
This is April 1945. That's when he finds out.
And what part did Marshall play in all this? He was...
Go ahead, Kevin, if you want to answer.
I mean, you probably know better than I. But, you know, he knew about the existence of the bomb, and he really didn't stand in Truman's way. He, you know, presented it to him like, this is a device we've been working on since 1939, technically, when Albert Einstein actually wrote a letter to President Roosevelt saying, you know, this is something we need to consider. And this was actually before a few months before the invasion of Poland that the idea went forward. And so, you know, Marshall being Marshall, probably very stone-faced, just presented Truman with the existence of this device. John, if there's anything you can add.
Yeah, and if at a higher level, even Marshall's boss, Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, is also a key figure in briefing Truman and getting him, a high level of understanding about the Manhattan Project. Marshall, in a way, you know, is representing the interests of the Army under whose auspices, the bomb is developed to some extent, because Marshall has a hand in choosing Leslie Groves, the guy who will oversee the project, although with the civilian approval of the scientists he will work with. So, yeah, Marshall has a sense of this, but in a way, he's no longer the key player by the time this thing comes to fruition. And I think it's partially because of the nature of the project, how secret it was, how expensive, that it becomes a higher policymaking kind of thing. It becomes now in the realm of Stimson and Jimmy Burns, the Secretary of State, and of course Truman himself. It's a military weapon, but with enormous consequences too, and I think all of them understand that pretty well.
He didn't pass the buck, President Truman. He was a haberdasher from Missouri, right? Right. And Kevin, why don't you tell us a little bit about President Truman? You know, the grit. The grit. Well, come on.
No,
he
just,
played the
I'm
piano, right?
The other guy on the phone is living in St. Louis, Missouri, but sure.
Well, you're both going to comment.
On the other end of the state, I guess.
You're
right?
Both going to comment. So you first, Kevin.
Sure. Harry Truman, veteran of World War One, an artillery officer, I would say a poor farmer in Missouri, also worked a haberdasher, came into the U.S. Senate, was considered a pawn of one of the political bosses of Missouri, but then he kind of broke away. And I would say his greatest contribution during the war before, you know, stepping into the role of president, even vice president, is he formed a committee that examined waste in the military. Having been in World War One, he was not impressed with regular army generals, and he thought they were pompous and kind of full of themselves. And so he really went after them for waste on U.S. bases in the United States. And his committee was so successful in spotting waste and cleaning it up that I want to say Marshall said he was worth, you know, a couple of battalions, that his efforts were so good. And what he did really comes into the presidency, you know, almost blind. He really was chosen with the knowledge that Roosevelt might not make it through his final term. And actually, it was Leslie Groves who made the claim that Truman really didn't make the decision to drop the bomb, that this thing had been churning along for so long that, you know, the momentum was behind it. But I disagree with that. When you're the president, you decide what goes and what doesn't go. And that was a decision true. He could have easily said, no, we've got the ground forces to do this. We've got the conventional power to do this. I could save it for another time. It really was Truman's call. John, I'm sure you can add a lot about your local buddy.
Go ahead.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, Truman is a fascinating figure in a lot of ways. I mean, he had emerged from the Pendergast political machine in the Kansas City area. He had been a local judge. He had done a lot of important jobs, and though the machine itself was, you know, rife with corruption, Truman, honestly, is a guy who preserves his reputation for being honest, for being above that kind of thing, and yet is successful. And it's one of the reasons, of course, why he's elected to the Senate. And he has this kind of under-the-radar persona and reputation, but that really was an important job that Kevin mentioned, is looking for waste in the war industries. This is one of the things that brings him to the attention of Roosevelt and his retinue, and it's no accident that Truman is chosen as the running mate, because Roosevelt had dumped Henry Wallace, who was a very, very left-wing vice president. And you have to wonder, if Wallace becomes president after FDR's death, what that means for America's relations with the Soviet Union and post-war policy and the Cold War and all that. Truman is chosen because he's more in line with FDR ideologically. He's a strong New Dealer, but also because he's acceptable to both wings of the Democratic Party on the issue of race. As a Missourian, which was a segregated state at that time, there's a thought that, well, he won't really, rock the boat in that regard to try and bring about too much change. On the other hand, he doesn't have a reputation as a strong segregationist and a strong racist or anything like that that would off-put many Northern Democrats either. So it's just interesting how he comes to the White House and how he puts his own stamp of approval, and his own stamp on policy. The other thing, too, Truman made an interesting statement during his time overseeing that committee, even before the war, when there was an amp up for war industries and all that before the U.S. was even involved. He makes an interesting statement: once Soviet Union and Germany are fighting, that they ought to just kill each other off. And it's an insight into his view of the world, and I think what really shapes American policy is, yes, we're fighting the fascists, the Nazis during World War II. We know they're terrible. And then after that, we know the communists are just as bad. And so this is U.S. policy throughout much of the 20th century, and you could argue even to this day.
Well, they drop another bomb, the U.S., on Nagasaki a couple days later. Then there's silence really coming from Japan. What's going on? Are they going to surrender? Was Hirohito going to surrender? And he made an announcement. For the first time, the people, folks, could hear him speak. So here he was talking about Kevin, why don't you give us a little bit about Hirohito?
Sure. He really was kind of a botanist and marine biologist. He was interested in science. He was a very quiet man. His reign, like a lot of kings of Europe in the 20th century, were kind of figureheads, and the military was really calling most of the shots, during the war. But it really was the biggest concern was, if Japan were to surrender, would Hirohito remain in power, or would he have to face, a court? And in Japan society, he's not just a premier or a king or a leader. He's a god. And so the idea of their god having to go in front of an enemy court is just so unacceptable to the Japanese. And that's something that's going to really burn in their hearts and keep them fighting. And so it was him acting independently, making the decision that the war had to end, that, he makes this recording and it's under guard on a record. There were serious attempts to try to get that away from people and not have it broadcast. But it was, and he basically says, we have to accept the unacceptable. We have to bear this burden. And like you said, it was the first time the Japanese people had heard their emperor's voice. It was overwhelming to a lot of Japanese, but they accepted it. And because we didn't persecute him, we left him in power. I think that went a long way for the good relations that developed between the United States and Japan after the war. And there is no insurrection when American troops come onto the main island. They offer up their weapons and surrender. It's a very impressively peaceful occupation and an end to the war.
John, August 13th, and here we are, August 13th, and Tokyo Bay, 900 soldiers enter Tokyo Bay, set foot on Japan. They were not given clips of ammo, folks, because they were afraid. Well, what were they afraid of, John?
Who, you mean they, the Americans?
Nah, the Japanese. Well, the Americans were probably thinking they're going to get hit by snipers or what. But what about the Japanese?
Well, of course there's that concern for the Americans. For the Japanese, as Kevin has rightly pointed out, once the emperor gives his stamp of approval on what the Japanese won't necessarily call a surrender, but obviously it is, part of saving face for them was to not necessarily call it a capitulation or a surrender, though they knew it was. And, the American occupation is the best evidence of that. The Japanese are going to accept the precepts of their emperor, most of them. Now, there are some exceptions. And you had, Bob, you had asked a few moments ago, what are they doing after that second bombing? What's going on? There's tremendous division in the Japanese high command, Japanese military circles about what to do. Some wanted to continue on. Others said it's time to end the war. Hirohito kind of breaks the tie and puts his prestige on the line to ending the war. Now, historians are really still arguing to this day about how much role he has in the Japanese war effort, war crimes, and all that. Unquestionably, he has some. He's in an interesting position because he is a god on earth, and he's so unquestionably revered and obeyed, and yet he ought to be above the mundanities and details of everyday leadership. And this is one of the things that had allowed the military to come to power, in essence, by 1940 and 41. So when Hirohito, though, gives his stamp of approval, saying it's okay for the Americans to invade, our honor is clean, we need to continue this, accept the unacceptable, as Kevin said, this leads to significant social control for most. There had been some young officers who tried a coup before this, before the Americans arrived. They had failed. So, yes, they had tried a coup. They had, and there was a tradition for this, too. One of the reasons why the military had come to power in the first place is that a significant number of civilian leaders in Japan in the 1930s who had wanted more modified foreign policy, more diplomacy with the West, so on and so forth, less aggression, they had been physically harmed and at times assassinated by radical officers. This had been tolerated. The tone had been set, and it's one of the things that leads to Japan having these warlords who lead it into the abyss. So once these warlords are discredited, and the bombings are a good example of why, now Hirohito feels strong enough that he can take the stand as well. And so most of the Japanese people are going to obey him. It's really a remarkable story of social control. And it's, the Americans make a very good call when they say to Japan, yes, you can keep your emperor. This saves the U.S. a lot of headaches in the occupation.
2 weeks later, August 28th, 1945, 400,000 troops with loaded rifles this time enter Japan. How in the world did they get 400,000 troops at that time? Where in the, did they land ships? Or tell us about that.
No, they're not all going in at the same time. This is just what's planned ultimately for the occupation. So you have a vanguard that goes in, and you have MacArthur, of course, who wants to lead the way along with many of his key generals, General Zuckelberger, General Kruger, so on and so forth. You have the ceremony aboard the Missouri on September 2nd, which is also a bit of political theater as well for both sides. A moment of triumph for the Allies and certainly the Americans. And you have in the wake of the ceremony aboard the USS Missouri, you have a flyover from hundreds of aircraft, B-29s, very impressive, to impress the Japanese with the power that is now upon them. And then, yes, you have the infusion of American soldiers and Marines, too, who are in a weird position of facing their former enemies, many of whom are armed but are no threat anymore. It's just a very odd thing, and I would argue probably unprecedented in American history.
Well, this was the first time that Japan had been conquered in over 1,000 years, and they had fierce nationalism and a huge mistrust of foreigners. So when MacArthur, he was put in charge, and when he came in there, as opposed to what happened in Europe, there was no fraternization allowed, period, whatsoever. But MacArthur did. He allowed acceptance of democratic reforms, and he really had non-fraternization policy. Tell us about that, Kevin.
Well, yeah, he didn't. I wouldn't say he welcomed or allowed change. He really was a strong force behind it. He basically democratized Japan, giving the vote to women, giving the vote to non-landowners, breaking up the land system that was, basically a fiefdom, and really changed the face of Japan. I've had a lot of criticism of MacArthur, but in studying his occupation of Japan, I think he deserves a lot of credit. He came in there, you were talking about people unarmed, he flew in there unarmed and then walked down the gangway from his plane when he first arrived in Japan, and, you know, made sure that he had himself photographed with the emperor. And that really sent a message to the Japanese of, like, you know, I'm standing next to your god on equal grounds. And he worked very hard to give democracy to Japan. In fact, there was a rise of the Communist Party at this time while they were setting for elections. And the common wisdom was, you know, we need to shut this down. And MacArthur said, no, we're going to, you know, this is a democracy. We'll let the communists run their candidates and, they, you know, they can see how bad they are and their philosophy is. And it worked just like he kind of predicted it. So, MacArthur did a very impressive job pushing democracy onto this ancient Japanese culture, making it a pretty dang strong industrial country and bringing it into the modern age.
John,
one that I would add had actually never been conquered in its many, many thousands of years of history, and had never lost a war in 3,000 plus years or so.
Well, John, why don't you comment on this, that Stalin had told, I think it was Truman, when they had a meeting prior to that, Russia was planning on invading Japan a month before the U.S. Tell us about that, John.
Well, the only time Stalin and Truman ever met face-to-face was at the Potsdam Conference in Germany in July 1945, and they did talk quite a bit about, you know, the mutual war they would soon have against Japan. Now, Stalin understood that he was to confine his operations primarily to Manchuria, to Mongolia, to Korea. The two powers had agreed to jointly occupy Korea while they disarmed the Japanese. Korea had been a Japanese colony, but the key argument in Japan itself was over the Kuril Islands and Sakhalin Island, which Russia and Japan had been arguing about for decades. And so Truman ends up as being, and MacArthur too, for once they could agree. They didn't like each other much, but they agreed on this. We're going to keep the Soviets out of the occupation of Japan. Mm-hmm. Stalin had lobbied to be part of it, and the Americans are very clear. This isn't going to happen, and you're not going to put military assets in key portions of the Kuriles. Stalin ultimately will back off somewhat once he sees the direction Japan is going, and he'll have more of a continental interest. And eventually he's going to make common cause with Mao Zedong and the Chinese communists, so on and so forth. But for Japan itself, it is going to be an American show. And the Americans are quite clear with their British allies, their Australian allies, so on and so forth. Chinese nationalist allies, we're running this, and it's going to be us. It's the U.S. almost solely that transforms Japan through the person of MacArthur.
Well, that's about it. We've got about less than, a minute and a half to go. But real quick, John, tell us about September Hope, the book that you wrote. Tell us all about that.
Sure. September Hope is about Operation Market Garden, which was an Allied attempt to end World War II in Europe in September 1944 with an airborne drop followed by an armored operation to knife into northern Germany, collapsed the Nazi regime and the war. It was unfortunately a real failure. Most of the fighting is in Holland, where the key bridges over the major river systems existed. And it ends up in this terrible grinding stalemate. And so the book looks at the American experience of the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions, your 101st, Bob, in Holland for that bloody and tenacious fall of 1944.
Okay, folks, that's September Hope. John McManus, I'm sure you can go to Amazon and pick up your copy. Kevin, we got less than a minute. Tell us about Patton's photographs, real quick.
These are the photographs Patton took with his own camera during World War II. I found them at the Library of Congress, made them into a book. I'm going to add one quick fact to the end of our conversation. There was something that was in Japan that was outlawed during the war that was brought back because of the American occupation, and that important thing in the history of the world is baseball.
Ah, yes, I think we'll end on that. John McManus, Kevin Himmel, thank you very much for being on our program. Until next week, folks, you are dismissed.